Good afternoon.
Wow.
Welcome to High Notes for week 7. I'm Alan Fletcher. I'm the president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm joined today by a violinist, alumnus of our program, all-around great guy, Robert McDuffie, and by composer Mike Mills. Mike Mills was also, I think you were the bassist with REM.
That's correct.
And also a composer for REM, the great band. And they are with us this week because Mike has composed a concerto for violin, band, and string orchestra that Bobby is going to play in the tent on Thursday evening. So what we're doing here today will be broadcast on the radio tomorrow. So if you are listening on the radio, you still have time to race over to Harris Hall box office and get a ticket for this really fantastic concert. The concert also includes Tchaikovsky's Serenade and something else.
The Road Movies of John Adams.
Oh, Road Movies by John Adams. Yeah, it's a beautiful concert. So this is something different for us here, and so we're going to spend some time exploring the nature of the collaboration between the two of you and the music that you're going to be presenting to us on Thursday, but I thought I would start with a little establishing a few stories, and I thought I would ask Mike to tell about the formation of the band REM, which I believe has its roots in Athens, Georgia.
Well, as with any great man or any great band, there's a woman behind it. When Bill Berry, the drummer, and I moved to Athens, Georgia in 1979, we were looking for some musicians to play with, and Bill started going out with a woman named Kathleen O'Brien, who had recently broken up with Peter Buck, and she realized that Bill and I were looking for a singer and a guitar player, and Michael and Peter were looking for a rhythm section, so she put us together for her birthday party, which we played, and oddly enough, even though there were only 250 people there, I've had 1,000 people come up and tell me they were there, so... It was quite the shindig, and we had a really good time, and we just enjoyed playing together so much, we decided to keep it going.
Great. So, and Bobby, you have your roots in Macon, Georgia, and why don't you start by giving us a quick tour of all the great musicians, including yourself, that have come from Macon?
Mike Mills is the first one who comes to mind, and Bill Berry, the drummer for REM. Bill and I used to play in the Macon Little Theater productions, Guys and Dolls and Fiddler on the Roof when we were 13 and 14.
Both of which I saw.
Which you said, thank you. I'm sure you got a comp.
Are you sure that's not like that party that a lot of people saw that, Guys and Dolls?
All right, there were 500 people and we've gotten 1,000 comments on it. But before I mention those amazing musicians besides the two members of REM, Mike and I grew up together in Macon singing in church choir and handbell choir when we were 12.
And were those your mother's choirs?
My mother was the organist and choir director at the First Presbyterian Church in Macon. Mike's father was her tenor soloist. And down in Macon, you kind of go to church all day. So we had mornings, two morning services. We had afternoon choir and handbell rehearsal, then an evening service, and there was so much Jesus. We went, then the Mills family, the McDuffie family would go back. The parents would get plastered, and we'd just hang out and watch some TV. And that lasted about 4 years.
But that doesn't sound very Presbyterian.
Just enough already. But my mother, remember, she would do Brahms. I mean, she did Brahms Requiem. She was playing and conducting Brahms Requiem, Rossini Stabat Mater, the Saint-Saëns Christmas Oratorio. His father sang all the solos and that. But you should hear my mother rehearsing those things. You know, these incredibly erudite works. And y'all have to enunciate. Y'all enunciate. Never forget that. Otis Redding grew up in Macon, Georgia. Little Richard grew up in Macon, Georgia. The Allman Brothers Band lived and worked in Macon. Lena Horn lived in Macon. I'm missing, who else? We're missing some people.
I was trying to think. You know, a lot of musicians came through that are a little less well-known than those.
Right.
A great band called Wet Willie is from Macon, Georgia. And I just wanted to say that because I like saying Wet Willie. But they were really good.
Marshall Tucker.
Marshall Tucker was from Spartanburg, but I think they spent some time in Macon as well.
Jason Aldean.
Well, the Capricorn Records had their headquarters in Macon, and they were the Southern rock record label. So everyone on their label was associated with Macon and of course, spent time recording at Capricorn Records studios. So Macon, even if these bands didn't live there, they certainly spent time there because of the record label and the studios. So,
right.
And as Bobby said, you know, people like Little Richard and Otis Redding, it's just a ton of musical history coming from Macon.
And Otis's family, even though he died in 1967, his family is still very active. His wife and his children continue promoting him and his legacy, and actually his 75th birthday celebration is in Macon in September. Chuck Lavelle, the great pianist, lives in Macon. He's the music director for the Rolling Stones, used to be in the Allman Brothers Band. He has a tree farm out there. So
right. He actually lives in Lazella.
Okay, Lazella. Okay, Lazella.
A suburb. Macon has a suburb. It's called Lazella. Yeah.
Right. Lazella is the Carbondale of Georgia.
No, I live in Carbondale.
I know that. That's why I said it. I know you do.
Okay. Any explanation why so much music from a relatively small city?
Mike?
Well, I think it's more about the South in general because throughout the South you have so many different styles of music that all keep bumping into each other. You know, you have the blues from way, way back. Country music, of course, is a staple. You have white gospel, black gospel. You know, rock and roll, certainly Little Richard brought rock and roll in as early as anyone did. So you have a lot of musical styles to choose from. You have a lot of people sitting in some really hot weather, and they want to do something that's not overly exertive. So you pick up a guitar or sit down at the piano or sing, and you just have all this music coming at you. You know, AM radio was a big deal, and so you could hear any style of music on the AM radio that you wanted to. And so it all just melded together, and a lot of people with time on their hands. And that's why college towns have so much music coming out of them, because you have a lot of kids who are just really interested in exploring things and not studying. And so that combination leads to musicians.
Okay. Now, Macon is a college town, and I thought, Bobby, you would give us a 90-second elevator speech about the Robert McDuffie Center for Strings.
Thank you. Mercer University is in Macon. It's a great school with 11 schools and colleges. We started an institute down there, a conservatory for strings. And while, as you know, there are way too many conservatories out there already, way too many schools of music, so we wanted to do something different besides just doing something for our hometown of Macon. We have a very high level student body, 26 students from 7 countries and 13 states, but we just don't teach them the regular music curriculum. We make sure that they take courses in business and accounting and law, public speaking, nonprofit, digital rights, micro-macroeconomics, so they can be prepared for the 21st century crazy, crazy world in music. So we just want them to be ready to make a living as independent contractors. And so that's why it's great that it's in Macon. Mike's come down and played with us down there, but we think it's the curriculum that's going to set us apart from other schools.
And correct me if I get this mistaken, but I think in a fairly early year, you already had an extraordinarily high level of talent. And the American String Teachers Association does an annual competition, and there were 10 finalists, and I think maybe 2 of them were from Juilliard and 1 was from Curtis, and 3 of them were from this tiny program in Macon, Georgia.
We have 7 McDuffie kids here at the Aspen Music Festival, so we're doing well. Thanks.
Now, Mike, after you stopped touring with REM, fill us in on the sort of range of activities that you've been doing.
Well, I have three primary activities I focus on. Of course, the concerto, which has consumed my life in ways I never expected. I play in a band called The Baseball Project with some old dear friends. We write and play all original songs about baseball. So, and it's actually really, really good. And you don't have to like baseball to enjoy it, because the songs themselves are just brilliant. And baseball itself is so often the story of life. Some of our songs have statistics in them, but some of them are just about humans and how baseball exposes who they really are. And I have one other thing. There was a really great rock band from the early 70s called Big Star, and they were sadly subjected to the vagaries of the business, which means that they put out two of the best records of all time, and no one knew about them, and no one ever heard about them until later. And they have influenced countless numbers of bands that you would have heard of. So a friend of mine named Chris Stamey decided to revive their third record, which is basically the sound of Alex Chilton going insane and losing his mind in the studio. And it is a very poignant and beautiful and oddly disturbing record. So we produce, we have shows where we produce that record with an amazing stringer. The thing that makes that special really is the string arrangements by Carl Marsh. And we relocated those scores, so we do that record live in various cities around the world, and we recruit whatever local musicians wish to participate. So every show is different, every show is special, and people find that this music that a lot of them have never heard of moves them in some really amazing ways. So Big Star Third is what that's called. So that's a sporadic project, and of course the Baseball Project is a seasonal project, as we really only play in the summertime. So that's pretty much what I'm up to.
Terrific. So how did the concerto project begin?
You go ahead.
Well, for those of y'all who don't know REM, I mean, they, you know, this phrase is overused, soundtrack of my youth, soundtrack of a generation, but that's what REM's music really did for so many people. Their music changed lives. And I, of course, got totally seduced for several reasons, artistically, obviously, but also because I grew up with the guy. And like others, just madly in love with his writing and the music. I selfishly wanted to play with Mike. While I love playing Mendelssohn and Brooke and Beethoven and Sibelius, and I mean, sometimes you just don't want to keep playing music of the dead white European males. So that's the reason I went to Philip Glass 5-6 years ago to write a concerto for me. It's why I like working with living American composers. It's why I'm going to play your piece on Saturday, which is a really beautiful piece, Saturday, 4 o'clock. 4:30, Harris Hall. I took a deep breath and called REM's longtime manager, and some say even fifth member of the band, Burtis Downs, who happens to be here in the audience today. And can we give him a big round of applause?
Why not?
He's a major figure in the REM. Life. I went to Burtis and I said, listen, I mean, what do you think? I mean, I think, you know, Mike is such a great composer and he's still playing so beautifully. And I mean, what do you think about just throwing out the idea of writing a concerto for band and violin and have him play and get a string orchestra and take it around? I mean, how stupid is it? I mean, what do you think? Burtis said, let's ask him. So a couple of weeks later, I took another deep breath and met Mike and Burtis, and I just threw out the idea, and Mike, listening, not saying too much, and then he said, I've got a theme already in my head. And that's where it started, and that was back in 2013 when that conversation took place. And we're just now getting it together.
I'm a very slow writer.
But, you know, Mike is playing as well. He didn't just write the piece. I mean, we're on stage together. He's playing bass guitar and and piano, and he has written a joyful piece. It is just great fun to play. It is not easy at all. We have an arranger named David Malamud who came in and fleshed out the string parts using Mike's music, and there's some really tough violin licks, and right after this talk, I'm going back to practice. But we had our first performance with the Toronto Symphony in June, and then we played a chamber version at the Rome Chamber Music Festival. Very intimate acoustic version, and that worked as well. So we're just getting started, and we have a 15-city tour in the fall.
And you'll do what you said you do with the other project. You'll pick up strings in each place.
We'll be touring with the Fifth House Ensemble out of Chicago.
How did you settle on scoring for a string orchestra? Did you consider making it a full orchestra, or?
I just thought it would be beautiful with strings. R.E.M. made a great album with members of the Atlanta Symphony. Even though they had some wins, but I just remember the lush string sound in that album. So I just I came up with the idea of using a string orchestra, not only for musical reasons, but I also considered the logistical reasons of touring. And we felt that it would be easier to tour with a smaller string ensemble.
And musically speaking, I think when you've got a four-piece rock band with drums and amplified guitars, to add a full orchestra to that would just be a cacophony.
Overkill.
If you will.
Right.
In terms of the writing of your part, there's a grand tradition in violin concertos of the soloists assisting the composer with sometimes a lot of advice, sometimes welcome, sometimes not as welcome. How was that process for you?
Well, he's really open. I mean, he would, you can describe this better than I can, the way you basically continued to write the way you did for the band with Pro Tools and then submit it to us. Why don't you?
Well, I wrote it, you know, for the rock band, since that's what I know, and I knew we'd have David Malamud to help out, you know, extending that into the symphonic world. A melody is a melody. It doesn't really necessarily matter what instrument it's written for or played on. So I came up with the best melodies I could, and then David Malamud and I worked really hard to apply them to violin, and he was writing a lot of 30-second notes and things, and I said, "Are you sure?" He says, "We have to take advantage of Bobby's virtuosity." I said, "Okay, you're the man." So we spent a lot of time. You know, I sent him my rock band parts, and then David and I got together many times, and he showed me how he thought it should apply to the strings and to Bobby's violin, and we adapted and changed that to where everyone was happy.
It's turned out great.
So what you have in front of you is a typical rock band chart.
Did you say chart?
Yeah.
We don't have charts. No. No. That was the fun thing about it. It's like we have to have a translator to explain what the conductor is saying to myself and the guys in the band, because we tend to memorize things because we don't have 7,000 notes in one piece as Bobby does in these. So that's another one of the fun parts is everyone's learning a new language and learning how to work together with approaches and sounds and ideas that have really never collided in this way before. So we are basically, I think, creating something new from the ground up, and that's one reason I'm so excited about it.
So how is what I would call the rhetoric of the piece? Is it soloist, like versus band, soloist emerges from band, soloist leads band?
Soloist does not lead the band. It is a prominent, you know, voice in the whole experience, but it is a rock and roll piece. I mean, this is Mike's terrain, and I'm just part of the I'm kind of part of the texture with a lot of notes. We talked about having hard driving rhythms and also really beautiful themes as well. His waltz, by the way, he's going to come up with a name for this movement in 24 hours, but right now it's a waltz. The first movement is Pour It Like You Mean It.
Pour It Like You Mean It, yes.
Pour It Like You Mean It. That's the first movement. But the waltz is achingly beautiful, and it's a joy to play. One of Mike's great pieces for REM is called Night Swimming. I don't know if some of y'all know that piece, but Mike's on piano, and I asked him to insert it into the concerto. I mean, if Shostakovich can copy himself, why can't Mike Mills? And it kind of ends with a, I don't know if you were thinking about this when you wrote the last movement, but it seems to be almost a throwback to the southern 70s and 80s sound a little bit, and kind of nostalgic for our time back in Macon, and it's just, it's a thrill to play.
Yeah, I thought there should be at least one movement that alluded to our common heritage down there.
So three movements?
Six, really. There's we're still figuring that out. We know there's six movements, but we don't know if we should call the first movement an opening and the last movement a closing, but it's a concerto. It's about 30 minutes of amazing music.
Mm-hmm. And continuous or?
A couple of spaces in between the movements, but we do have some attakas.
Mm-hmm. And the strings, are they a separate unit, or is it like Eleanor Rigby? They're a sort of halo of sound.
No, they're very much a part of it. There are some extremely lovely parts that David and I have put together for that, and I think that's one of the challenges for the guy behind the desk out there is to incorporate the band and the strings on an equal level, so that the nature of the two types of music blends in the way that we want it to. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean their strings are. I consider that there's Bobby and then there's the rock band and strings that are on an equal footing. So that's what we're trying to achieve, is just to show how good Mr. McDuffie is and then also show how much fun it is to try to combine these two separate genres.
Yeah, and that is the toughest. The balance of sound has been the issue. I knew it would be an issue, but I didn't know it would be as time consuming as it is. So we work hard in advance to find the right balance, because you want to hear the orchestra. Orchestra's, I mean, it's a great part, and we don't want to cover them. So the staff here is doing a great job.
So please tell me you haven't put a pickup in your Guarnerius.
Actually, this man right here is one of the owners of the Guarnerius that I play, and he gave me permission to put a little pickup mic on the instrument, and it's still in one piece.
Okay, but you didn't bore a hole.
Like No. And I'm not going to smash it against the amp either.
Okay, but that's you have enhancement, or would you say amplification?
That's a good question. Is it enhancement or amplification?
Both, actually.
And how about the string ensemble?
They're mic'd. Okay. They're mic'd. They don't have individual mics, but you have standing mics throughout the ensemble.
Now, as we all know, the tent here is a really beautiful acoustic space. It's a very challenging space to use amplification in. And I know you had a lot of rehearsal already. How's that going?
We felt better last night. We have another one tonight, and it'll be perfect by Thursday.
Okay.
Says the incredibly sanguine fiddle player.
Mm-hmm. And when you're touring, you have a 15-city tour. What kind of venues are you going to be in?
Concert halls, 2,000-seat concert halls, including Harris in Chicago. That's our last. Is Joan here? That's our last stop.
Terrific. Well, Harris is actually well set up for amplification. So,
but some places like Strathmore and Washington, we started in Miami, and several college venues as well.
Great. Well, let's pause. Actually, this is a little different from the way we usually do it, so we're going to need the mic traveler. And see if you have comments or questions for Bobby or Mike, and then we will go back into another segment after that. If you would like to say something, wait for the mic, because it's for the radio broadcast. Right here in the middle.
First of all, I wonder when you're going to be at Strathmore. I live about 3 miles from there. But
I think it's early November.
Yeah. But my question is, I first heard of Philip Glass, I think in 1974, in a Horizon magazine article that said he was the bridge between classical and rock. And I've been a devoted fan ever since then. I wonder if you could comment on that.
I think that's fair. I mean, Alan, you might want to pitch in here as well with this, since you're knowledgeable about Philip's music. I do know that musicians like David Bowie and David Byrne and Paul Simon looked up to Philip Glass and worked with him. And actually, Mike has played with Philip before in Carnegie Hall, right? Did you do something with him?
Yeah, it was a very strange meeting. My band was playing for the Gay Men's Health Course at Carnegie Hall, and I was playing a piece that I wrote on piano called At My Most Beautiful, and Philip wandered over and says, "How does that go?" And he was watching me play, and I said, "Do you want to play?" So he sat. So we did it that night with both of us on the piano bench. I was just playing my regular part, and he was improvising some beautiful stuff up on top of it. It was kind of a neat experience.
But when he wrote the American Four Seasons, he used the same instrumentation as Vivaldi, but he, instead of the harpsichord, he used the synthesizer that would tap into the Philip Glass rock and roll sound. And I wanted him to go back to that sound that turned David Bowie on and turned David Byrne on. So I think that's a good way of putting it.
Over here.
How did you cast the students that are playing with you?
I didn't, but I trust Alan and Azador and the folks here, and they sound amazing. I have one of my students in there, two of my students in there. And we're really fortunate that we have David Halen, the great concertmaster of the St. Louis Symphony, leading the orchestra.
Well, I'll give a little behind-the-scenes look at how that works. This is a bit of a detour, but so we have 630 students from 40 different countries here, and we're running four orchestras and an opera orchestra. And the orchestras are structured differently, such that the winds, brass, percussion, and harp players rotate through all the orchestras. So they will have a chance to play on a Sunday, on a Friday, where they're working with a principal player, a professional, and then they'll have a chance to play on Wednesday, because in that orchestra, the students play the principal roles. And if you think about the logistics of rehearsing four orchestras in an opera company where the personnel change in a rotating basis, it's pretty gigantic. Then when we have something like this, we need to pull students, and typically the faculty make the assignments, but they will say, "Oh, that kid played a Shostakovich 8, and that was a really big play, and let's give them a little more relaxing week and put them into this project." And they have to play the Tchaikovsky as well as the Mills. So on the other hand, it's a different kind of rehearsal for them. And so we're always looking for each student, how much rehearsal time have they spent each week, and we're tracking that. As another bit of trivia, we commissioned a software with the Metropolitan Opera because we considered that we're the two most complex performing organizations in the U.S., The Met is putting up 8 different operas each week and is in rehearsal for other ones. And so they have to know where every player is at all times and where all the equipment is at all times. But we have to know where the contrabassoons are. Because if Robert Spano is giving a reading, he says, you know what, let's do Hari Janosch. We have to hit a button and know these are the instruments we're going to need, these are the players we're going to need, this is what all the people who play that instrument are doing right now and for the next 3 days to know whether we can say, hey, why don't you come down and go to a reading of Hari Janosch? So that's a bit of an answer. So Bobby was talking about his Presbyterian background. This is sort of like a Quaker meeting right now. right down here in front. Oh, we'll come to you in a sec. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for being here. It's good to see you again, Bobby. I have 2 quick questions. I'm hoping that there's a way we can access online the cities of the tour and the dates of the tour upcoming. And so if you tell us.
I know it's on my website. Camille, is there another site where the tour can be accessed? And it's a Columbia Artist website, but also just robertmcduffie.com. The dates are listed.
And I'm sure eventually it will be up on the REM HQ website for all you rockers out there that tune into that.
Perfect.
And we have a lot of rockers out there today.
And a lot of rockers. I'm wondering also if there's any possibility that you will be recording this performance in some format that might be accessible to us at a later date? Like
we are recording. Burtis, are we recording? We're recording this piece over Labor Day weekend, and the release date is October 14. And it'll also be available on iTunes and online, and hopefully you can steal it on Spotify.
Okay, right down here in front.
Thank you. Your previous answer may have addressed my question that I'm going to be asking, but listening to you, it seems to me that the piece is not fully set. You're still tweaking it, which I find very interesting. So by tomorrow night, when you perform it, do you feel that it will be set? Or because certainly the rock piece, the instruments that you address don't have charts, do you feel that the piece will continue to evolve? And do you feel that perhaps every performance might be slightly different from
others? Right. That's a great question. When I say we don't have charts, we don't have sheet music. We have everybody has their own shorthand for how they notate how songs should go. So it just looks like squiggles and symbols from Mars and things. So there are ideas. People have to write the arrangement down in order to do it before they remember it. And yes, I think constant revision is a good thing. Certainly, you know, every time you play it, you hear different things. Some things rub that shouldn't. Some things don't rub that should. So, I think every version is definitive, and it's definitive for that moment. So what we play tomorrow night may be exactly the same as what we record in September, or it may not. That's the beauty of music, at least from my point of view, is that you can adjust it and adapt it to whatever, I guess, me as the composer or whatever advice I get from Bobby or any of the other musicians. If they have ideas and they say, I think this should go a certain way, that's certainly worth considering, and if I think it's a good idea, we'll do it.
Right, and as it is now, the music is ready to go. We're not tweaking the music, or we're just tweaking the sound right now. So once we get, and we basically had it last night, so it'll definitely be ready tomorrow. But the music is we've worked hard, so it's ready to go.
Well, I have a comment that turns into a question. I was in a conversation last week with a very, very important classical composer. who was observing that in the economy right now of classical music, you get a first performance, and there's a lot of attention. Many people think way too much attention to, you know, things being a premiere. And you make the recording then you realize you want to make big adjustments, and particularly in the world of opera. In the history of opera, there's almost no case where a major work was not substantially rewritten after the first performances. But that can't happen anymore because you've made the recording, and now people think that's the way it needs to go. Mm-hmm. And I think, so I'd like Mike to comment, in the rock world, you work and work and work, and you assemble an album, then it becomes a thing. And is it hard to change it? I mean, Grateful Dead did, but.
Well, it's for, to me, at least in the rock world, an album is an encapsulation of what the band was at that moment, at the months that they wrote and recorded the record. And that, of course, will never change. But that doesn't mean that the piece can't adapt and change as it grows and as you play it in live situations. As far as this piece goes, I think by the time we record it in September, we will have played it 3 times. And I think, you know, I will be pretty happy with exactly where it is, and we'll record it as such. But that doesn't mean that if, you know, if there's something I want to change in subsequent performances, I can do that. But I think where the music is right now is exactly where it should be, and I'm perfectly happy with where it is.
And it's going to have legs. I mean, I didn't want to come to Mike and say, let's just do 1 or 2 performances of this. This is another issue with opera because of all the moving parts and logistics and expense and everything. That's why the Philip Glass piece, I went to someone like Philip because I knew that he would write a piece that would endure. And that's the same mindset I had with Mike. And yes, if we tweak, you know, along the way, it's still gonna be the piece that we worked so hard on.
And what would be the situation in the future to have a different band playing the piece?
You mean the rock band aspect? I would hope that that would not happen, but because it's the guys, William and Patrick and John, have worked so hard to get where they are, I would prefer to keep it together. But, you know, certainly you could teach anyone to learn it, and I could change a part if I had to, because these guys, they all have day jobs. So they've been lucky enough to get the time off to do these shows and to do the tour. If at some point in the future that couldn't happen, we could rearrange the band, but I like it the way it is.
Down here?
Here, which is why I'm so far forward. How much influence, if any, does the audience have?
To this point, I haven't heard anything that made me want to change. But really, I'm so concentrating on the band and the music and what I'm listening to that I haven't really gauged the audience reaction enough to change anything. And at the same, you know, even in historical, you know, the past of all my music, I don't really trust the audience in the sense of changing any composition. If there's a piece they don't like, I just take it out of the set, you know, in the REM days. If it didn't go well, we just wouldn't play it very often. But as far as this, I think if you start looking for signs and signals from the audience, you could chase your tail for the rest of your life, and that kind of scares me.
Tony, we played it twice in 2 very different environments. The first, the premiere was with the Toronto Symphony. They had 2,800 people, a lot of young people. Concert started, we didn't even come on stage until after 11 at night. There was a 2-hour performance outside by an REM cover band. It was an event. It was a big event. So everybody was in a great mood, and they did, you know, they loved it. Just 2 weeks later, we played it at the Rome Chamber Music Festival. We played a chamber version of it for 300 people. And, in fact, a lot of your fans had
met and gotten married at REM concerts. They were out in front of the gate trying to get in. But both reactions were great, and I think that's a testament to what he did.
In this piece.
Yes, or some kind of combination that would include vocals.
I haven't thought of it for this because to me, from what I understand, the defining aspect of a concerto is the soloist. I mean, that is the focal point. That is what the music is all there to support. The as David said, the virtuosity of the soloist. I hadn't thought about it. I knowing the logistics of trying to make a rock band and a string section and a violin work already, to introduce vocals into that is just my head's going to explode. So, who knows? That someday, you could always incorporate a small chorus with it or something like that. I mean, I'm not a good enough singer to keep up with Bobby, it would be so discordant. It would not be good. But there's no reason to say that at some point you couldn't get a small chorus as a nice adaptation to this.
Well, there's a Busoni piano concerto with men's chorus. It's one of the weirdest pieces ever. it's also almost never done because how often do you have a men's chorus lying around? Following the question, though, how much of the organization of your own REM music, say, is from the vocals, and how different was it to be writing a really extensive, long piece that didn't have the words?
Well, REM wrote differently than most bands in that the lyrics and usually the melody came last. Peter and Bill and I wrote the songs, and they had to be interesting to us even before there was a melody or words, which I think was one of the strengths of my band, was that the songs were already there even before Michael put his parts on them. So I tried to do something similar with this. I tried to write interesting chord progressions and then put good melodies even on top of that. So you get some sort of a nice layer, a nice complexity. You get a song that isn't just a couple of simple chords carrying a melody, but something of strength and a good basis underneath it, and then a beautiful melody on top of that.
Yeah, actually, Ravel made that comment that he would say, the piece is finished, I just have to write the melodies now.
that was sort of my thinking for a while, and then I realized I was just getting to the hard part.
Good afternoon. My question is, what was the hardest part in composing the concerto? Was it the rhythmic section or getting the balance between Robert part and band and orchestra? And what was your inspiration to write the concerto? Thank you.
Well, the inspiration to write it was when Bobby proposed the idea to me. I was at a point in my life where the band was retired and I could either, goof off and play charity golf events for the rest of my life, or I could step outside of my comfort zone and try to do something that really, frankly, scared the hell out of me. So I opted to do this. And as far as the other part of your question, it was, can you say again what the other part of it was, the first part?
What was the hardest part in composing the concerto?
The hardest part was making sure that the melodies were worthy of this. I've always been a melody guy. That's one thing that I've always enjoyed about any music, whether I was making it or just listening to it in any other situation. And melodies are what's going to endure. If anybody's going to remember a song or a piece of music that's been written, it's the melody that's going to stay with them. And so just trying to ensure that the melodies were not just interesting, but transcendent, if at all possible. So that was where the most pressure came from.
So, Bobby, did you have input into technical aspects, like may I please have lots of double-stopped harmonics, or may I please not have any double-stopped harmonics?
He did. He David Malamud, the arranger, did throw some really crazy technical passages in there, and I cheated a little bit and took away some of the double stops, and so the melody would still pop out. It's still an incredibly hard piece. I had a couple of suggestions about repetition of themes or something. I mean, really not much. I mean, the piece was already really good. But I must say, I was really proud. I made my first rock and roll suggestion last night at the rehearsal, and it sounded good.
Wait, which one?
Asking the drummer, Patrick, to just go crazy before a violin entrance. I was pretty excited about
it.
That.
It was a great idea, and it worked really well.
Thank you.
You're still not getting composer credit.
Really quickly, just a comment. I have two children here at the festival, and I've seen REM, I think, 35 plus times. So I'm one of those people that didn't work very hard in undergrad.
Thank you.
But we had a cool experience two nights ago where I was talking about wanting to go to this and really excited, and none of the eight kids that I was with knew anything about REM, and we had an opportunity to play some at that point. And I think you're going to gain a number of classically trained music fans as a result of this, so anecdotally it might be really kind of cool to see who goes back and listens to what.
Well, that would be great, because it's a blending for me, because as Bobby said, my father was a dramatic tenor, and I grew up listening to classical music at night when I was going to bed, and of course I was a street urchin in Aida at Theater Under the Stars, so I am actually a practiced opera participant. But so no, it's always been a big part of my life. I've been listening to it, since I was a little kid. So I love the fact that hopefully people can see that the Venn diagram does overlap somewhat. Even if it's something we have to jam together, we're going to do it. And I would like people to see, because rock and roll, it's been so, is it dead? People have said for years rock and roll is dead. Well, it's certainly harder and harder to be original with it. And, in classical music, brilliant as it is not necessarily reaching the audience that I think it should, or that any of us think it should. So, hopefully we can accomplish more with this than just writing and playing a really nice piece of music. Hopefully we can have a ripple effect and broaden its appeal to people on both the rock side and the classical side.
So, Bobby, in your schedule, if you were touring and you had three concertos that you were touring with, that would be fairly normal, I would guess, and you do whatever amount of practice that takes. Do you stop everything to concentrate on a project like this? The American Four Seasons, there must have been 90 dates on that first tour.
Right. The American Four Seasons is around 90 right now. I wish I could have stopped more for Mike's piece. I had to do, I was scheduled to do a Bernstein Serenade and a Lalo Symphony Espanol and another Four Seasons. So I would sometimes finish the performance and go to the hotel room and work on Mike's piece. So the fact that we've gotten two performances under our belt, makes it a lot easier. But in a perfect world, I would have been able to take 4 months off and just practice on the concerto. But it's a lot of notes going in the head.
And Mike, you said you spent about a year on this project.
Well, I had a couple of ideas really early on when Bobby suggested it, one of which I kept and one of which I got rid of. And I'm a sporadic worker. I don't sit down and zoom in and focus for 3 or 4 days on end. I can't really work that way. So I try to sit down and play every day, and if something comes to me, then that's what I grab a hold of and try to, you know, flesh that out and make it whole. So really, musically, I've been working on it for 2 years, but just, you know, I've got other projects as well, as Bobby. So, you know, it's always on either the front or the back of my mind, but it's on my mind for sure. And it's just, you know, wherever I can find inspiration is where I find it.
Terrific. Well, I think we're going to wrap up if there is nothing else from the audience, but, Thursday night, it is tonight if you're listening on the radio. It's tomorrow if you're listening right now. And in the tent, it's a fantastic project. There's been tremendous interest in it. So tell all your friends and bring your kids. Thanks.
Thank you.